Hello and welcome to our annual Oscar podcast. I'm joined today by our culture columnist, Bill McGarvey. Good to see you again, Bill.
Good to see you, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Now, this is the eighth time we've done this, and unfortunately, we're not joined by Father Jim Martin, who has done it with us before, but he's only seen one of these films, and you've seen all of them, so I'm glad you're here.
The ghost of Jim Martin will be here in the form of me. Hi, how are you? Yes, I've only seen, what movie did I see this year?
I think he saw Grand Budapest Hotel, so he'll have to weigh in on that later. But let's start with American Sniper, probably the most controversial film. I have not seen it, but I've read a ton about it. What did you think of it, Bill?
I enjoyed it, and I wasn't really aware of the controversy around it until afterward. I'd heard some interviews with Bradley Cooper, a long-form interview on the Howard Stern Show, where he talked about the story behind Chris Kyle, who made it sound, at least in the interview, that Chris Kyle was not some sort of Sergeant Rock type figure, for lack of a better term, some sort of warmongering crazy person. The movie certainly doesn't represent that. I wouldn't say it's either pro or anti-war. It certainly shows the main character being very damaged by his experience in war, and certainly a lot of the men around him extremely damaged, both physically, emotionally, et cetera, and the families around them. So it would be hard for me to make that out to be, and I think we've seen a spate of these movies in the past 5-8 years about the after effects of war and how damaging it can be, and especially this war that's the Iraq and Afghanistan war that have been extremely damaging. So the controversy really took me a little bit by surprise. I thought it was a good movie. I thought it was a well-made movie. And I, as somebody who was against the war in Iraq 12 years ago, I hardly felt that it was some sort of grand apology for the war and sort of defending it in that way.
Now, this movie's done incredibly well. It's made, I think, over $250 million. Is that just explained by the fact that people perhaps have not gotten a movie from Hollywood that tells the story of the Iraq War in this way? Or?
Great question. I would say that Chris Kyle, the way he's portrayed in the film, is a hero in the sense that he is great at what he does. It is not a pretty job, but he's very well suited to it in terms of his skill as a marksman. And it also shows, I think, the realities of people who are damaged by what they're made to do, by killing people. People, some of them, they have no idea whether they're necessarily guilty, et cetera, et cetera. There's an ambivalence about, I think there is a sense of heroism. It certainly doesn't come down and sort of blame the troops in any way, shape, or form. These are people who are doing their job, so to speak. And the way Chris Kyle died was, I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but it was certainly tragically after the war. So, and it's also a really fresh story. So I think it's on a lot of levels, it's well done. But there have been a lot of good movies, I think, about the war. There was a great movie Tommy Lee Jones did a number of years ago. I can't remember the name. But it was about his son who was an MP and kind of went on a killing spree. And just about the after effects of war, PTSD, et cetera, and how damaged these people are.
All right, the next film, The Imitation Game. Now, here's one I was looking forward to seeing. It seemed like a great story. I knew the backstory about this individual. But
did you know it ahead of time?
I knew the ending. I knew what happened to him.
Okay.
And I knew the story of the Enigma.
Okay. I didn't, yeah.
Machine, et cetera. But I was disappointed. I felt like it's a good story. There are good elements there, but it just didn't come together for me.
I definitely felt this. I mean, I enjoyed the movie. It's hard for me to, especially movies that are sort of like The Theory of Everything, which we'll talk about a little later, about historical figures. I find myself, and American Sniper as well, I find myself always bouncing back and reading the Wikipedia articles or different sort of reviews or true life stories or documentaries about the subject. And I definitely felt, in terms of The Imitation Game, going back and seeing the sort of non-sanitized version of it, which was definitely more complex. And that said, I thought it was an interesting take on a very complicated British intellect, mathematician, and how they sort of broke this code that the Nazis had, and how they really dealt with some moral quandaries that were kind of shocking that hadn't expected. So while I didn't think it was best picture worthy necessarily, I thought it was a well done film, but I certainly don't see it as being something that everybody it's not The King's Speech, which I thought was a more powerful film.
Yes, I would agree. I would agree. I mean, I don't think they have to follow the historical record exactly.
No, right.
And we'll talk about this when we get to Selma.
Sure.
But in this case, I think the complexity of this man and the life he lived was actually more interesting than what they put up on screen.
Yeah. And what did you, in terms of after the war?
Well, also, yeah, his own sexuality, which is something that they hint at the film, but they're kind of, they shy away from getting into too much detail. And there was a piece that from somebody who knew him and said, you know, he wasn't afraid to talk about these things.
Oh,
yet
he wasn't.
The film kind of tiptoes around it.
Oh, that's true. It is true. It's sort of a secret for him. You're right. He's somebody who's afraid that he's going to come out that he's homosexual. And there's the Keira Knightley character is a woman who he's, I guess, very good friends with. And that's true to life as well. But it certainly got interesting after when I read the historical. And they hinted that at the very end of the film. But it's the filmmakers, I think, did a good job. But definitely soft-pedaled some of those things as well, I think, to tell a story of heroism, probably.
Right,
In some ways, about World War II, heroism of intellects, so to speak. So, I don't disagree with you on that.
And they make him out to be fairly antisocial. I mean, he's like this classic Asperger's type who can't interact with anybody there. And they play that up to the point which, A, I don't think it was necessary. He certainly had some kind of social issues there, but from what I read, he was a fairly social guy, and so they sort of play up that for dramatic effect, but it didn't feel correct.
That's interesting because you definitely get the feeling when watching the movie that he was not a likable person beyond his ideas and his brilliance.
Right,
sort of like a Russell Crowe in Beautiful Mind sort of thing of a guy that actually he was more likable, but that this guy was sort of this genius who nobody could stand.
Now another historical film we just mentioned is Selma. Which now there's been a ton of controversy about the Lyndon Johnson character and the presentation of how involved he was, if at all, in the organization of Selma. And they portray this as he kind of resists it, correct?
Yes. Although, again, I sound like an apologist for filmmakers everywhere. clearly, my passions or my opinions lie with the filmmakers making the choices they make. Yes, I can see the argument that LBJ is perhaps less sympathetic than a lot of people who were, well, Joe Califano, I think, was involved with the administration, said. And I haven't read Mr. Califano's response to these things. That said, I think the choices the filmmakers made, and I think they're valid. I don't think that Johnson comes off like a complete heartless pig. He's a politician. He understands. I do understand historically, apparently, that the March on Selma was his idea, and you definitely don't get that sense in the movie. Anyway, I guess I understand some of that sensitivity, but it doesn't necessarily. It didn't change my impression of the film at all, which is.
You liked it? Or?
I thought it was a very powerful film, very, very powerful. And I wasn't really expecting to like it because anytime you do a biopic, it's hard when you have a figure like Martin Luther King Jr., who we all know what he looked like and what he sounded like and how he moved. And I was really worried, and I remember seeing the previews thinking this is going to be difficult, kind of like when you see Ray or something like that, which is a good movie, but you end up, again, going back to the original material. And what do you do with this dramatically? And I remember thinking to myself about 30 minutes into the film, how I was no longer thinking that this is an actor portraying Martin Luther King, that this felt like a dramatization of real life, and I thought it was fascinating, and I thought it handled King and his complexity really well. I thought it showed him to be, in many ways, a greater man because of his complexity and his own clay feet in many ways, and the way they handled it, I thought was very well done and very delicate. And also, the fact that the movement—I thought it made, again, the brilliance of making it about one component of the
one
movement,
episode
one episode
life.
Of the movement, rather than the grand sweep. I thought was brilliant, and I thought it really showed him to be. I just thought it was a great choice. I thought it was really well done, and I didn't know much about Selma going in. I did go back and read about it some more, but it makes him out to be a complicated man in a very complex time.
Yeah, it's amazing to me more filmmakers, writers don't take that approach because it worked very well in Lincoln too, which is just focus on, you know, 12 months in the life of this figure and, you know, one particularly dramatic period, but you avoid the pitfalls of the traditional biopic, which is just sort of like checking off the boxes and stuff.
Yeah, this is him as a young man, as a middle-aged man, as an old man.
Yeah.
Now, I hadn't thought about Lincoln, but you're absolutely right. That is sort of a corollary here. Selma is really about one episode in the man's life after he was already a titanic figure, already a big figure in American life. He'd already won the Nobel Prize. I've had friends say to me, boy, nobody wants to touch the period after 66 or 67 when he became very vocal against the war in Vietnam, et cetera.
Right. And talking guess, more about poverty. And
yeah, and I'd be interesting inequality. To see that. It would definitely complicate things. But I found it very powerful, and I found myself very moved by it, very, very moved by it. Especially and I should say this because we're talking on America's podcast. It deals with faith.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't forget that Martin Luther King was motivated primarily and animated by his convictions about his faith, his Christian faith. And as a person of faith, you go this, and Selma was where he called on lots of white clergy from around the country and around the world even, I think, to come to Selma and march with him in a show of solidarity. And in that sense, it shows the power that actually religious convictions can bring to social causes.
And I forget how young he was, too. How old was he in Selma? Was he 40 yet?
Or
was
he might have been bordering on 40, 30. I don't know for sure, but he was
He wasn't 50. Young. I mean, he didn't make it. He didn't live to 50.
No, so I don't think he did. Yeah. You know, so he was not old. And Coretta Scott King was, I don't remember the actress's name. I should, but she was wonderful. And that's a phone. Is that the ghost of Jim Martin calling? I don't know what you want. The ghost of Jim Martin. Bill, I liked Selma. Jim doesn't sound like that. I know he's going to be upset. Anyway, I found it to be a the actor. He's a British actor. And
Who played Martin Luther King?
Yeah.
David Oyelowo or something like that? Yeah,
he was in another movie called A Most Violent Year,
yeah.
which I love.
We can talk about later. Yeah,
And he was in some other things as well, but I thought he did an amazing job. I would say that if there's any weakness in the film, it is the portrayal of LBJ and George Wallace and even J. Edgar Hoover. Again, difficult to see these actors portraying these men who we know very well. And I think they were perhaps a little bit more caricatured than people in the movement. But I didn't have a problem with that in terms of as a filmmaker's choice. I really didn't.
All right, next film we've both seen, Whiplash. You were just saying you love this film.
Absolutely loved it. I saw it back in, I believe, November, and I called a buddy of mine. I'm a musician as well, and a buddy of mine.
And a drummer.
I'm a drummer, too, so I loved it for that reason, because he's a Buddy Rich fan.
I'm a drummer. Yeah.
I loved Buddy Rich as a kid. He's a brilliant drummer. It's about an 18, 19-year-old young music conservatory student at a fictitious music school here in Manhattan. It's considered the greatest jazz program around. It's very esteemed, and gets into what is considered the great band on campus, which is a very important thing in terms of your pecking order in the world. And the legendary composer is played by J.K. Simmons, who hands down needs to win the best supporting actor.
Right, yeah.
The conductor, he's amazing in it. And I thought it was great. I immediately called my buddy who had gone to Berklee School of Music and asked him if it was really like this. It's really a story, even if you're not interested in music necessarily or drumming or any of the above, it's a movie about obsession and control and authority and desire. It's really a taut film. It is about as high. It's really wound tight in the best kind of way.
I think. There's just this release at the end that's very satisfying.
Yeah, it's great. What did you think of it?
Yeah, no, I was really impressed by it. I mean, I didn't know where it was going. There are a couple twists at the end which are really fun to watch. The final scene is amazing. Mm-hmm. I was also kind of wondering, you know, is this really the culture here? I thought it was interesting, the relationship, obviously, this young guy with the J.K. Simmons character, who's kind of like a father figure, but a very domineering father figure, who he wanted to please so much, versus his real father, Paul Reiser, who's this like super nice guy, but and they get along well, but he still seems to be yearning for kind of, I don't know, this, you know, he wants to please this other father figure.
Anybody that's familiar with ambition on some level and desire on some level can relate to what goes on in this movie. That's really what it's about. I mean, music
ambition,
is just the medium that is taken, but the desire for greatness, the desire to please, to get ahead, that's what this is really about. And it just happens to take the form of a music sort of backdrop. So in that sense, I thought it's really, it was a brilliant study of kind of obsession and the desire for success, the desire for approval. I thought it was really brilliantly done. It's one of the few movies that this year that I think really lived up to the hype that I heard about around it. It was really well done.
Even though he's a jazz drummer, he's there's something in there about rock and roll drummers. Like, they're not real drummers.
Yeah, that was fun. No, it doesn't bother me at all. Because, honestly, I know friends that are jazz drummers, and they're incredibly technical. I mean, jazz is where these guys are tremendous players. It's kind of the joke is jazz guys, you know, can play circles around rock guys. I'm not a jazz, you know, lover, although when I see Buddy Rich play, and when I did see him play in college back a long time ago, and it was something I will never forget. Brilliant. I saw him in a club in Washington, D.C., and he's a genius of the drums, and so it made absolute sense that somebody would want
to be Buddy Rich.
Oh, absolutely. Buddy Rich is, you know, unique. He's a legend, is just simply put.
And Fordham gets a shout out. I think his girlfriend
is from.
Not really
a great one.
No,
yeah.
Not at all. She's sort of the aimless student, and she's like, "Oh, and I go to Fordham."
Yeah, and he sort of makes some slam. I remember talking to a friend of mine after this. Well, Fordham kind of got a backhand in this. It's not, but not horribly. But it was, yeah. And but really, it's a bit of a coming of age, and this kid is you sort of relate to him, but you also see sort of so
he's
much.
He's kind of a jerk at the point.
He's struggling with his desire for his own greatness and to be the best, as an 18-year-old, 19-year-old can. And I thought it was just really, really well done. And again, J.K. Simmons, and I forget the young actor's name, but he was great as well. I thought Paul Reiser, who I'm not necessarily a huge fan of, I thought did a really good job too. So really well done. But again, J.K. Simmons, you've seen him in a lot of things, in Juno. The Spider-Man movies. He was J.J. Jamerson or something, the head of the Daily Bugle.
Oh, right, yeah.
He's a great character actor and absolute revelation.
All right, well, moving on to another film I've seen is The Grand Budapest Hotel, which came out about a year ago, but is now back in the spotlight.
I don't get it. Did you see it?
I did.
I liked it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if you've seen a Wes Anderson film, and I thought this was one of the better Wes Anderson films, and Wes Anderson is one of those auteur filmmakers who you know him, you know, pretty much as soon as you see his films, you know his style and you know what he does well, like Tarantino and some other folks, Scorsese to a certain degree. But there is this sort of precious kind of world that Anderson, only Wes Anderson, can conjure for himself. And Grand Budapest does it well, and Ralph Fiennes does a really great job, and it's a cute, sweet, quirky, quirk is a kind of descriptor that always kind of gets attached to him. I don't know why it rises to the level of Best Picture. It seems to me if you're going to give a Best Picture to Wes Anderson, it should have been for Rushmore. But anyway, I liked it, but I was kind of amazed that it's getting the attention now that it is. It's almost like, did the Academy not know that Wes Anderson's been making
well,
these
I mean,
for
some him? Of it, you're right, is like, for, you know, it's a career, a recognition of his work. Mm. You know, when he was doing Rushmore, he was not that well known.
No,
it was his second film.
True.
I will say, though, and I think he's dealing with more mature themes in this. And also the previous one that takes place at the summer camp, Moonrise Kingdom.
Right.
I think there's, that one was about more about childhood. This one is about another young character who plays the bellhop, but is dealing with these forces. You know, there's obviously in the background is a war in Europe. It's obviously World War II. They don't name it. Mm-hmm. And you hear about, you know, at the end of the film, they kind of tack on that, well, many people died, and there was a plague that killed many people. And it's a reference to the Holocaust. That's how I read it. But it's not something they explicitly talk about. But it did kind of make the film more haunting for me than some of his earlier works. And there was more violence in it. I mean, it was still a Wes Anderson kind of violence, you know, with like fingers being severed, but in a very kind of artificial way.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think he was trying to struggle with these larger issues in a way he can, which is with his kind of filmmaking.
That's interesting you say that, because it is a fictional world, and it's in a land of, that there is no name, whatever. It's
some like fictional Eastern European
country.
Right.
And, and it's funny that you say that you know that it's, because of course it is of a certain time and space that you could make the correlation. And yet I think Wes Anderson lives in such a hermetically sealed world that the notion that any of that seriousness or solemnness would come in sort of would ruin his world. So his movies never have that weight for me. Because, and it's not that I think he's great at what he does. And the fact that you have a voice as so strong as Wes Anderson's is an enormous accomplishment. But at a certain point, like some other filmmakers, I feel like I've seen the film. I know his style. I know his interests. And I didn't get that sense of moving beyond these kind of, again, endlessly quirky characters, sort of strange, you know, very mannered interactions. So it's funny. I did not have that same sense of any of that. To me, that's all projected on there by folks. But that's interesting that you did. I didn't get that at all. I liked the film. I don't mean to say I don't like it, but I've also seen, like Tim Burton to a certain degree, and and certainly Wes Anderson, and I think Quentin Tarantino to a certain degree. There's a feel and a voice that's very, very clear, and it's not that it's not valid. It's just at a certain point, it's like, you know, you've it's not new, and so it's sort of.
Well, what I think distinguishes it in part is the Ralph Fiennes character mm-hmm. and his portrayal of it. I think he's a real heavyweight in terms of an actor, of course, but. Mm-hmm. That character, I read somewhere, I agree, I think it's probably his best character since Max in Rushmore. You know, somebody who really comes alive, is very memorable, and there's this juxtaposition between his fine manners. You know, he's the maitre d' of this hotel, but he's kind of coarse, too. Like, he'll curse and say, well, forget that, you know, I won't curse on air. But right. He goes back and forth, which... I don't know. It made him kind of unexpected and interesting to watch.
I never heard it put that way. That he is the best drawn character since Max Fisher from Rushmore.
Yeah.
And that I could see that being true in many ways. I mean, certainly better than Steve Zissou or I mean, who were somewhat interesting. But that's a great point. And yet he's still a grown up Max Fisher. He's still a petulant, strange.
Right.
His passions are strange and weird. And
yes.
And yet, but that's a great point that it is sort of. And I think Ray Fiennes did a great job of it. But that notion of this being this sort of, you're right, the latter day Max Fisher or an adult Max Fisher is probably true. I would agree with that.
All right. Now, Boyhood. Here's a film that's gotten a lot of attention. We'll turn next after this to Birdman. They seem to be going neck and neck for best picture here. Did you like Birdman? Did you like the conceit of it? Sorry, Boyhood. Did you like
Boyhood?
The conceit?
Yeah. I think the story behind the making of Boyhood is in many ways more compelling than the story itself, than the film itself. And that's not to say that I think there is an achievement. If best picture is about an achievement in filmmaking, I can see why this would be chosen for that reason. Although personally, I think I probably would have chosen... I wouldn't have chosen probably any of these as best picture. There, I would have chosen Calvary, but of the movies we've talked about that are nominated, I would probably have named either Whiplash or Selma for very different reasons. But all that said, I think Richard Linklater did a really good job with the sort of coming of age story of a young child, and I've never seen it done before. In that sense, I think fans of film and cinema are probably interested in that whole notion of over 12 years filming the same actors. So I can see why people liked it. I did not find the story itself, although I can see it haunts some people. I know some people that absolutely loved it and it mesmerized them. I did not have the same experience with it. It's not that I hated it. I did not have this sort of tremendous connection
kind
to
of like
it.
Religious experience that some people have had. With
yeah,
this
some
film.
People have said that's what they said. People, I have to admit, it's not something that I relate to. And that, I mean, I think somebody told me that some young men have really, really found it powerful, perhaps because it's about the coming of age of a young man. Is that the experience you had with it?
Well, I was really moved, I think, by the first maybe half or third of the film, okay. Because that I think is when it's the quickest movement when you're seeing this child grow. And
yeah.
You know, I have a young child too, and so you start to see that. So I think as a parent, it's very moving. I mean, I think the bulk of the film is really his teenage years, and specifically like his latter teenage years. And that might have been a dictate of the filming schedule that, you know, they just did some quick shot, you know, some quick episodes in the early years and then did the bulk of the filming later.
Mm-hmm.
So it dragged a little for me during those periods at the end. But, I mean, seeing the passage of time and seeing, you know, here's a kid growing up through... the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for us, that may seem like, you know, kind of a quick moment that we've, you know, perhaps like to forget. But, you know, for this kid, this was his whole childhood or almost whole childhood.
Yeah.
So to think of it in those terms, like, and for me, sometimes I forget, like, for me, like, the Reagan presidency was a big chunk of my young adulthood.
Sure.
But I don't think of, you know, now it's just to see the passage of time and how, you know, that those 10 or 12 years have gone by and how it's really a whole childhood right there before you.
There's a scene going on when the Ethan Hawke character is there doing Obama. They're campaigning for Obama
in
2008 in Texas, which is interesting, right? So, and I think in that sense, seeing characters grow up, and I do think you can where the parent characters, Patricia Arquette and Ethan Hawke, where they start and where they end up. Especially for actors of some who are known, it in that sense it's really interesting because there's been some talk about, geez, Patricia, did you mind being shown 12 years ago when you were much thinner, and you're 12 years older and you've aged? And to her absolute credit, she's said, no, this is real. This is what I would look like. This is what. And I thought that was really well put, and there's not a lot of vanity in it at all in that sense. Ethan Hawke, I think they probably have to dress him up to look a bit like rougher than, or middle aged than he is. In this, but I do think in that sense, you know, from a point of view as a viewer, I think that's interesting. And from what the actors did, I find Richard Linklater's films often, like when I saw Dazed and Confused, I felt, boy, this feels like 1976, and that's great. But he's really good at making snapshots of things sometimes, and sometimes I wonder what the compelling point of it is. I loved his movie Bernie. I thought that was great.
Yeah, yeah, that's also great.
Again, Linklater's a talented filmmaker, but Boyhood, and I can see if Boyhood wins why it would, but it was not something that stood out for me as this tremendous film of the year.
Well, let's switch to Birdman, and this is a movie I really like. I think we had a conversation about this once. You were not as much in
You really
love
liked
with
this.
I did, yeah.
What did you really like about it?
Well,
I didn't hate it. I did not hate it.
I saw it twice, and I had different reactions both times. I think the first time I saw it, I mean, this shows you sometimes, like, if a movie catches you at the right time,
yeah,
you know, you will always remember it because you're like, and I just remember just the energy, you know, the soundtrack of the, you know, this drummer that's playing throughout the whole thing. The cinematography, you know, this quote-unquote one shot. It's not one shot, but it makes it looks like one shot. Mm-hmm. And just the energy of the acting. And it's, you know, it's a New York story. And, you know, being from New York, I kind of like that piece of it and picking out the spots. But, and I think what ultimately clinched it for me was the fantasy reality combination there, which wasn't fully explained. And I kind of like that. I kind of like the fact that they did not, for those who haven't seen it, this is a character, Michael Keaton, who played Birdman, you know, like Batman, like Michael Keaton did many years ago, and this character still kind of stalks him, and he still has some of these residual powers. And for me, that felt, I don't know, just make it kind of entered the realm of fantasy, but in, you know, or maybe like magical realism is a better way to describe it.
No, I think that's a great, and it's funny that you say, because, and for people who don't know, the character's Birdman, who actually, when they flash back to what he looked like in the Birdman character, which is this huge franchise he was a part of back earlier in this fictional character's career, he looks very much like, the headpiece looks very Batman-like from the Tim Burton, you know, Michael Keaton Batman films. And so I think, you know, on a sort of promotional level, I think perhaps I was too exposed to Michael Keaton early on, saying, well, that really isn't me at all. So I think the notion that you would sell this film, and I think they were trying to, at least on some levels, that this is kind of Michael Keaton's story, which is an actor who relatively early in his career gets an enormous opportunity to play an enormous character and eventually gives it up to his long-lasting sort of frustration. He's not taken seriously as an actor, and so later in his life, he wants to do this Broadway play.
It's Raymond Carver's short story.
And he's going to to gain some legitimacy on the stage. And I think the fact that Michael Keaton was like, well, that's really not me at all. I would have done another Batman, but X, Y, and Z, and I'm pretty, but it didn't happen. And so he's been very vocal about the fact that this is not me, you know. And so I think it took some of the edge off it. I thought some of the filmmaking in terms of magical realism was interesting. I thought certainly the pacing of it was tight and interesting. And maybe if I'd seen it again, I would have a different feel for it. I think I was expecting a lot, and perhaps went with a lot of expectations. I like Michael Keaton a lot. I thought Ed Norton was great in it. I thought he was great in it as a sort of pretentious method actor.
He was really good. I think that's one of his best roles.
Absolutely. You love to hate him in this film. He's really annoying. And they really captured that sense of, like, frustration and anxiety and all this thing, all these great things. So it was well done in that sense. But I don't get this sort of, is this really one of the ones that thinks is a really hot contender for best film?
Yeah, I mean, it's won a bunch of the early awards, and Boyhood has won also a bunch. So I think it's between the two of them.
Maybe I really should see it again. I would say I perhaps should see it again because you've seen it twice because you just so much love it.
Well, no, I wanted to bring my wife to see it because I enjoyed it so much. Yeah. And this the second time around, I saw it more as a kind of a commentary on our social media world, you know, where his daughter is, you know, on Twitter and trying to get him on Twitter. And, you know, he starts trending when he's filmed, you know, walking in his tidy whities through, you know, and it's partly commentary on, you know, acting in, or celebrity in our social media age. But part of me wants also is, I think it's the ending of the film that I like the most. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, I was talking to somebody recently who had a very different interpretation of the ending and thought it was more of a downer than I did. Mm. And I got very, like, wound up because, like, no, that's not what happened. Because for me, I think why I like the film is because I felt like it looked like it was going one direction, which, right. I mean, I think we could say, I think it looked like it was going towards some sort of suicide.
Oh, right.
And then it takes a different turn. And for me, it felt like an affirmation of life at the end. And that's what I think I liked the most about it.
That's, you know, that's really interesting, because as you're saying this, I'm thinking, geez, what was the ending now? I mean, there were so many magical, realistic moments, and you're sort of wondering what's real and what isn't.
Well, it's his daughter looking out off of the balcony, you know, out the window for her father. She doesn't know where he's gone.
Yeah.
And she looks down, and then she looks up. And then you see this look on her eye, which I can only describe as it's like beatific. It seems like she's almost like she's seeing something divine. And, you know.
That's right.
And that's just how they end it. So I think that's why I like it.
I will try to see this again, and we can't redo the podcast, clearly, but I'll go on record as saying I liked it, was not blown away by it. Again, there are other films that we can talk about later.
Right. Well, but I know you're blown away by Calvary, so we'll talk about that.
An important film, yes.
All right. Well, I think we just got one more, which is The Theory of Everything, which I have not seen. Seemed like a hard movie to see. You know, another movie about somebody's suffering. Was it more uplifting than I'm describing it?
It's Imitation Game Part 2, another British intellectual that has had a difficult road, although I think you could argue that Stephen Hawking, who's still alive, and apparently was kind of gave his blessing to the film, you know, is a complicated character. Again, like these biopics, I enjoyed the film. I thought it showed a touching relationship between him, this genius, and his wife, who is a lovely woman and the mother of their children, and who struggles with being with Stephen, and as he's descending into his, I guess his ALS, and he's becoming less and less responsive,
right.
or that he's much less and less ability to understand him is lessening. And it did touch upon some issues of faith and about God and belief in God, because Hawking is from the very get-go a very adamant sort of atheist. He's a man of science, and his wife is in the film. She's portrayed as Church of England, but is a churchgoer and is a musician. She loves to sing. She has a singing choir, etc. And so that is an interesting sort of back and forth between the two of them a little bit, although. And then it becomes more complicated in terms of relationships, and it's I think it's well done. Of course, apparently in the real life, the conversations and the arguments around God versus no God were far more vicious apparently in real life than they were in the movie. So I think they might have sanitized him a little bit, which understandably, the way I've read about it is once he writes A Brief History of Time. He becomes such an intellectual superstar that he became insufferable, at least in his wife says, his ex and now ex-wife's estimation. But they're apparently on decent terms now. But it's in the sense of an early career film about how they met and about how he came to be who Stephen Hawking is. I thought it was well done. And really, it's a story of the wife, the spouse, dealing with both his celebrity and his disability.
Well, we will look out for that one maybe when it comes out on DVD. But let's turn to a few films that perhaps should have been nominated. All right, Bill, Calvary, we've talked about it. Remind us why you like this film so much.
This whole section should be the woulda, shoulda, shoulda. The section where I believe these things should have been nominated. I'm surprised they weren't better films. I've written about this in America. I think Calvary is an extraordinarily powerful film. Brendan Gleeson as a priest who enters after his wife dies and his priesthood in Western Ireland. And basically, he's almost set up in some sort of existentialist world in Western Ireland, where everybody in his parish is some sort of modern form of disease in terms of just mental illness or just absolute existential despair. It's fascinating. It's powerful. It's a commentary on priesthood in a post-sex abuse world in a way that I find to be beautiful and powerful. So I can't say enough about how I've seen that movie 3 times, and I've taken, like you've done with Birdman, I've taken people to see it. I think everybody in seminary should see it. I think it's a very powerful movie. I remember it took an evangelical friend of mine who was always arguing about the difference between Catholics and evangelicals, and I just said to her, I said, this film is what Catholic is to me. So I thought it was, I can't say enough good about it.
Yeah, this is one I'd like to see a second time. I think again, it's sometimes the moment when a film catches you, and I enjoyed it, and I liked Brendan Gleeson very much, but there were points I found it a little slow, and maybe it was also the sense of humor. It takes a little getting used to the McDonough sense of humor. Particularly the brothers have this kind of dark humor, and you kind of have to get into it. But I can certainly see it.
Didn't hit you as strongly, huh?
Not initially, but I mean, I will go back to it. I mean, I think it's interesting to kind of, it's beautifully shot. I mean, those shots of Ireland, yeah. And I think it was, as Anthony Lane pointed out, I won't take credit for this, but you've got Ben Bulbin there in the background, which mm-hmm. is there's a famous poem by Yeats about that particular spot. So there's this kind of the weight of Irish history looming above it.
Haunted by a lot of things. And yet, I don't consider it, and I know McDonough himself does not consider it an Irish film. It doesn't. It is set in Ireland, and that's interesting, and it adds to it, but it's not an Irish film in the classic sense.
Right.
That you have to be Irish to understand it.
No, and it's not our parents' Irish film.
No, it's not at all.
It's not The Quiet Man.
No, not in the long shot. And my passion for it can sometimes maybe, I do know people that didn't like it. I know some priests that didn't like it, which surprised me, but I can't argue enough that I think people should see it.
All right. Well, another one. You'd mentioned A Most Violent Year, and this one is still kind of sitting with me. And it's maybe because it would totally unexpected. I was expecting like kind of a classic gangster film, and it's almost like an anti-gangster film.
No, it's a fascinating. To me, it was like a Sidney Lumet movie. Yeah. It was something. Did Lumet make Dog Day Afternoon?
I think so.
And,
yeah.
And it was an early seven. It really is a film set in 1981 in New York.
Yeah.
And it just captures the bleakness of New York City. And the bleakness of this life. This is a guy in the outer boroughs who's an American, but he's of an immigrant Hispanic family. And
which they don't touch on much, but you know that
he's
is.
A type. He's he's not necessarily Ecuadorian. He's sort of a person who's come here for the American dream to make it, married a beautiful woman, and has grown a successful business in New York in a very, very violent—
In the oil business.
In the oil, home heating oil business. Yeah. And it's about his desire to grow. In some ways, it's about very small potatoes in terms of he wants to buy this piece of property in New York that's going to help his business grow. And it's, again, a very taut psychological to a certain. I've seen this film twice, actually. I went to see it recently with a friend. And I just found it really great. I'm amazed it got no attention. I thought it was really, really well done. Jessica Chastain and Oscar Isaac. I think Oscar Isaac is like a young Pacino in it. He's like in from, you know, sort of Godfather, you know, Dog Day Afternoon kind of era, Serpico era, New York Pacino. So I thought it was really well done. And it does sit with you. I think it does sit with you. And especially if you like those films from the 70s of New York. I think it absolutely evokes that.
I really liked it. And largely, you know, I grew up in the outer boroughs. You never go into Manhattan in this film.
It's very true. You're right. It's not a Manhattan film.
It's not a Manhattan movie. No, so it gives you a better sense and reminds you like what New York was like.
Yeah.
You know, 30 years ago, it wasn't this, you know, this is pre-Giuliani.
Right. It's not cleaned up.
It's not cleaned up.
And you're right. It's like this sense of, that's a great point that you grew up in the Bronx and the notion that you're not of Manhattan and the glamour and all this stuff. Now, these are hardworking people who are struggling to get the American dream. And there are a lot of impediments and a lot of corruption in the way.
And there was glamour to Manhattan, but there's also more danger. I mean, it was like there were certain neighborhoods of Manhattan you did not go into.
Right,
so
it's
very interesting. I watched this movie. It was actually on my father's birthday. He would have been 40 when this movie was made in 1981. And I'm going to be 40 this year. So I was like having this weird experience. I was thinking, well, this is his life at this moment in New York, and that, you know, and I'm in a very different New York right now.
So. That's very true, and it's a moral, not to overplay this, but it's a morality, it's a twisted little morality tale on some level about the American dream. Albert Brooks does a really good job at it as well, but Oscar Isaac,
he's great.
There's a scene where Albert Brooks, who's his lawyer in this deal, says, "Why do you want all this?" And he thinks he's talking about the property first. No, not the property. Why all this? And it's amazing, this Oscar Isaac character, who's the main character, who is sort of the driver in sort of the desire and ambition. And he's a good man. He's an honorable man in his own mind, and I think he is.
Yeah.
He doesn't understand the question. He's like, I don't understand. So it's almost as if, why would you question the American dream? Why would you question this? And in that sense, and toward the end, he says, this is the most right thing. So he's sort of a weird amalgam of that sort of American optimism, that American sort of manifest destiny, you know, sort of, but mixed with early 80s Ed Koch, New York.
This writer-director is definitely one to watch. J.C. Chander, who did Margin Call, in 3 years he's on Margin Call, All Is Lost, which I did not see.
Did not see that.
And then this one, you know, three very different films, but very interesting.
Bleak.
Bleak.
I didn't see All Is Lost. I did see Margin Call, and I liked it a lot. He's a good filmmaker. I think he's got. Yeah. He's able to. He
can seem to move from kind of genre to genre.
A little bit like Alexander Payne, Nebraska. Yeah. There's a certain sense of bleakness to his films that I think is really compelling. I think the guy's good. He came from commercial filmmaking.
Oh, yeah.
Made commercials, which is interesting to me.
Now, speaking of bleak, maybe we can touch upon Foxcatcher before we go. This is a depressing film, but I found it was a really slow burn. And I was really, you know, I was closely watching it because I was expecting it to explode at any moment.
Yeah, another great film, I felt. I mean, I think as Bennett Miller did this, the guy who did Capote.
Felt like Capote to me, some of it. The landscape, the shooting.
He likes very eccentric characters.
Yeah, yeah.
Or he does well with them. And Steve Carell was great in this. And Mark Ruffalo and Channing Tatum. But Mark Ruffalo especially I thought was also great. As I have some cousins who are wrestlers. And the way he and Channing Tatum held their bodies, the feel of the film just felt like wrestling. It's just what I know of wrestling. And the strangeness that was John DuPont. And actually, it's funny where John DuPont lived. His estate was not very far from where I grew up.
Grew up.
It's outside of Philadelphia. Yeah. He was way further out. But it was fascinating to watch. It was actually where Episcopal Academy, which it moved their current, which is a big school, an old private school in Philadelphia, moved out to. And I just found the study of this man who was a strange and sad person of enormous wealth, complicated and weird, and again, very tense film, and just really the tone of the film. This in A Most Violent Year, just great tones to the film.
Yeah.
Whiplash, great tones. Small, in some ways, small subject matter, but I think really well made films. Really well made.
Well, there were some great films this year. Maybe not all of them made the Best Picture list, but
definitely
still more to see. I want to see Mr. Turner. Haven't seen that yet.
How about Mr. Turner was good. Ida.
Ida was really great. Yeah,
brilliant. A Polish film.
We reviewed
film.
That. Yeah,
brilliant film. What else?
Yeah, it was a good year.
Definitely see Ida.
Okay.
All right,
Bill. Well, thank you very much. We're going to hopefully do this again next year, and we'll have Father Jim with us.
Yes, the ghost of Jim Martin will return.
All right, Bill. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. See you.